This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security or www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is a landmark 50th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and today we're shooting video as well as recording the podcast. You can find the video on Silver Bullet websites. And I'm happy to have with me today Richard Clark. Hello.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Richard A. Clark is an internationally recognized expert on national security, counterterrorism, and cybersecurity. He's an on-air consultant for ABC News and teaches at the Kennedy School of Government. Dick served for 11 consecutive years in the White House for three different presidents, including a stint as special advisor to the president for cybersecurity. Before his work in the White House, Dick worked in the Pentagon, the intelligence community, and State Department. These days, Dick lives in Virginia and is a partner at Good Harbor Consulting, where we're shooting this video. He is the author of a number of books, including Against All Enemies and his new book, Cyber War, which is orange, and we'll talk about that today. He has a BS from Penn and an MS from the MIT. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it a lot. One of the points you hammer home in your new book, Cyber War, is that the U.S. is more dependent on cyber infrastructure than potential enemies, say, North Korea or Iran. When you factor in defense as well as offense, it seems that we're not in such great shape from a cyber war perspective. So what's to be done to change the focus of the emerging cyber command from offense to defense?
Well, several things there. That's a rich question. First of all, we are very dependent on cyber systems. Mm-hmm. And when you think about one's cyber strength as a nation, I think you need to take into account your dependence, the level of your dependence on cyber, and your ability to defend mm-hmm. that, and your offensive capability. All three, I think, are
yep.
factors.
Yep.
U.S. Cyber Command actually says it has a predominantly defensive mission.
Do they?
Yeah. But the only thing they're defending is themselves and the Pentagon and the rest of the military. Mm-hmm. They're not defending even the civilian agencies of government.
Right.
That's Homeland's job. Mm-hmm. And someday they may be able to do that. Homeland can't do it today.
Right.
And Cyber Command is certainly not defending things that are owned by private companies like banks or the power grid or railroads or anything else. Mm-hmm. So I think in answer to your question, what's to be done, there has to be a big policy decision
right.
at the highest levels to say somebody, whether it's Cyber Command or DHS, somebody should be given the responsibility to defend the nation as a whole against cyber espionage, cyber crime, mm-hmm. and heaven forbid, someday a cyber war.
Right. So asymmetry and asymmetric warfare are also parts of the situation that you have to consider. You know, it's fairly straightforward for one person to cause a really big impact in a cyber attack, and it's really hard to assign blame. So, you know, can we alleviate that problem, or are we really stuck with it? I guess it's related to, you know, the guy who tried hard to blow up Times Square very poorly.
I think one person can do a lot of damage, but not a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. I think at the moment we're talking about nation states and maybe criminal cartels to do things like take down a power grid. Mm-hmm. I think one individual probably won't have all the skill sets and all the abilities and all the simultaneous activity that has to go on to make that happen. Mm. So we're talking right now about other nations, and there is an asymmetry. So you have North Korea, for example, mm-hmm. which has virtually no cyberspace of its own, which has to go outside of its country in order to attack.
Right.
You know, they go to China and they rent hotel suites and set up in Chinese hotels. They mm-hmm. go to South Korea, where they blend in and properly operate out of safe houses.
Right.
So here's this nation with no cyberspace and with very little else going for it. And yet it has an ability to launch cyber attacks against the United States. So there's a threshold that you have to get over, but it's a pretty low threshold.
Mm-hmm.
And then any nation, no matter how small, no matter how poor, if they get above that little threshold, then they can do real damage, even to a big country.
Mm-hmm. So I've written a bunch of very geeky books on software security. Some are good guy books, like software security, and some are bad guy books. I use that with scare quotes around it, like exploiting software. And the bad guy books outsell the good guy books about 4-1. So it seems that people suffer from what I call the NASCAR effect when it comes to computer security. Watching the crashes is way sexier than preventing them. How can we get people to realize the importance of cyber war and the problem that we're facing without resorting to FUD? Or is there...
I've tried to do that in the book. I tried not to overstate the thing.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things I say is, look, we're not going to have a cyber war just because nations went out and got cyber weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And the analogy I make is there are 9 nations that have nuclear weapons that we know of.
Right.
And they don't go around using nuclear weapons just because they have them.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, nobody's ever used a nuclear weapon in anger except the United States, and mm-hmm. we did that in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
So just because nations are acquiring cyber commands does not mean they're going to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
It works the other way around. If a nation makes a decision to go to war for the reasons that they normally do, economic, political, ideological, then they look for what their weapons are. So no one is going to attack us in a big way, cyber war,
mm-hmm.
Just for the heck of it.
I'm sort of thinking about how you engage the policymakers and the public
right.
in understanding this without, you know, look, some of the things that can happen, you and I both know, and the people that listen to this podcast know that they're serious and they yeah. really can happen. But when you say it to the general public, they think you're Chicken Little.
Right. So. And so you have to be very careful.
Yeah.
And therefore, I talk about cyber espionage as a motivator.
Because
mm-hmm. people can't get motivated about cyber war. It's mm-hmm. never happened in any big way, certainly not to us. Perhaps it did to Estonia and Georgia and other countries. But it hasn't happened to us in a big way. And until it does, people are not going to take it seriously.
Right.
So let's talk about cyber espionage as a thing that happens every day and is costing the United States a lot of competitive advantage in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're spending stockholder money and taxpayer money on R&D.
Right.
And then that R&D is acquired for pennies on the billions by people who hack in and steal it.
Like the Google attack, for example.
Google attack is one example of the attack on the F-35, mm-hmm. an airplane that hasn't even flown mm-hmm. in service yet, and yet vast amounts of data about it have been stolen.
Mm-hmm.
300 British companies got a letter from the head of the British Security Service saying, you have to assume your company has been successfully hacked by China.
Right.
It doesn't just happen in Britain. And it's happened in the United States, and we just haven't sent that letter out yet.
Well, do you think the people, when they get the letter, are going to believe it? Is that?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do. Now, first thing the CEO is going to do is call his CIO, his CISO, and say, why didn't you tell me this?
Right.
And in part, that's because some of these people don't know they've been attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these attacks are really quite subtle, and they can exfiltrate large amounts of data, terabytes in some cases, of data without people noticing.
Right.
So
the best attacks these days are that way.
Yeah.
Lots of stealthiness going on.
Yeah, exactly. And so the CEO is going to say, look, I gave you a lot of money. You bought antivirus stuff.
Right.
You bought intrusion prevention stuff.
Why
you bought firewalls. What was up? You mean that stuff doesn't work?
Right.
And the answer is, yeah, it doesn't.
Yeah. We know that. Us geeks, we're with you on that one. So, your book has some really fascinating stories in it. I particularly like the description of how information warfare played a role in Israel's attack on the Syrian nuclear facility. Really, it was fun to read. But it also describes some scenarios that are kind of basic, like the thing that you invoked a minute ago, the DDoS attack on Estonia. You know, that would not work against Amazon, say.
Right.
Or worse yet, the North Korean script kiddie stuff that happened recently. So isn't it dangerous to mix very serious cyber attack possibility and these stories of intense, you know, command and control, radar system, routing versus the script kiddie stuff?
I think we have to tell people what has actually happened. Give them the complete inventory.
Gotcha.
What is everything we know that has happened
in
the way of cyber war as opposed to espionage and crime?
Mm-hmm.
And true, there are pretty basic tools used against Estonia and against the nation of Georgia, but they worked.
Well, right. And, you know your target, I suppose.
The banking system in both countries was disrupted badly.
Mm-hmm.
Communications in and out of the countries were disrupted badly. Mobile telephones, the internet, all very severely affected.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're right, if that happened here...
Well, we got Akamai and edge routing and all sorts of other stuff.
Oh, and Arbor and Mazu and all sorts of companies that specialize in DDoS attacks.
Yep.
And we probably could do a better job, but the largest DDoS attack that anyone's ever seen by volume was July 4th of 2009, and that was the North Korean attack on some things in South Korea, but mainly on things in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And that worked in taking some of those things offline. Now, frankly, it didn't make a big deal of difference whether those things were online or not, because they're just public web pages.
Right.
But for all of our skill at DDoS mitigation, sites did go down.
Mm-hmm. Right. So putting out the whole range is an important part. But, you know, I guess one of the problems that we're sensitive in the security industry is the overuse of FUD and, you know, people that tend to overemphasize. They're banging the drums all the time, thinking like the SANS guys, banging the drums overly much. And but the question is whether the public will be able to discriminate between something like the Israeli taking down the Syrian air defense versus just a DDoS.
Well, we try in the book both to tell the readers everything we know that has actually happened and to say what it was significant and what wasn't.
Right.
So obviously the ability to take down an air defense network just before you bomb, you know, I think that goes without saying is important. And we say the disruptions that the North Koreans did on July 4th were largely attention grabbing.
Yes.
And didn't have any disruption.
Yep. Okay. I think you got the balance right in there, by the way.
Good.
And I actually kind of, the doomsday stuff that some reviewers have been harping about, it's because I don't think they really understand what can happen. On page 86 of the book, you say, and this is a quote, "Of the three things that make cyber war possible, the most important may be the flaws in software and hardware." And as you know, I couldn't agree more. I think we've made tangible progress in software security over the last decade, especially the last 5 years and on the commercial side, all without regulation. What's your view on the importance of software security and whether we're making progress? And, you know, how do you, from your seat, how do things look?
Well, I think if you somehow waved a magic wand and solved the software security issue, 90% of this problem of cyber penetration would go away.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's left after that is human engineering
and
misconfiguration. So software assurance is key to the solution of this problem and key to the elimination of the threat of cyber crime and cyber espionage and cyber war. That having been said, yeah, we've made progress, but we've made progress from a really low beginning.
That's right. It's easy to double.
Yeah. And there's a lot more that has to be done.
Yeah.
But you know, and you've written about how it can be done. I mean, it's possible. It just takes longer,
mm-hmm.
and you have to have higher standards. And people have to insist on those higher standards.
Yeah.
NASA, when it had human beings in space, back when the United States was a spacefaring nation, you know, it used to insist on very high standards of software quality and software assurance. It would never have done a commercial off-the-shelf acquisition for a key program.
Mm-hmm.
Other people aren't like that.
Well, of course, you know, NASA was also spending the government's money, and they spent something like $25,000 a line, from an estimate that I got from John Knight from UVA.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we can do it. Whether we can spend that much is a question, too. How, you know, the balance is a tricky part of the whole thing.
That's right. And I think we have to ask ourselves, what is the balance? How much could you lose versus what's the cost of having a secure piece of software? And you don't need secure software on everything. But maybe you do need it in the Defense Department for command and control. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we shouldn't have U.S. Cruisers running Windows.
Right.
You know that almost every locomotive running on U.S. rails today is still using Windows XP and downloads an update twice a day.
Great. You know, it's
I don't like that idea. Trains, big trains running around, I don't like that idea.
Well, yeah, but you know, we can also compare Windows 98, which didn't even have a kernel, yep, to Windows 7, which actually seems to kind of work from a security perspective. And that demonstrates the progress, too.
Yeah, no, there's been progress. There absolutely has. Yep. But I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, it's not over by any means.
Oh, no.
And what can we do to improve it? And one thing we can do is insist on certain functions being performed by high-performance software.
Right.
And we ought to, I don't want to regulate how you do it, but I think we might regulate that these are functions that require high-assurance software.
Mm-hmm. You seem to put a fair amount of credence in the idea of scanning and possibly blocking network traffic as part of the solution to defending ourselves. I think that's one part of your defensive triad, mm-hmm, even. And I think you've been unduly influenced by Ed Amoroso, by the way. So there, Ed. In some sense, describing software exploit at the level of packets is kind of like describing the brain at the level of neurons. And we can only really solve this problem, in my view, by building systems that aren't broken. You know, so trying to protect the broken stuff from attack aimed over the network seems to me to be futile. And I'm not sure I buy into the whole network monitoring thing. Plus, it brings up, you know, personal liberty issues.
It only brings up personal liberty issues if, A, the government is doing it.
Right.
And B, the companies that are doing it are not regulated with regard to privacy. Mm-hmm. So Google is reading your email, your Gmail.
Not mine.
You don't have Gmail. I don't have Gmail either. Yeah. That's why. But Google is the price of getting Gmail for free. Google actually reads the words,
right,
of your email,
yep,
and then allegedly stores that information so they can tell advertisers about you. Mm-hmm. That bothers me. But in any event, if we had AT&T scanning software that scanned things moving on its backbone, we'd have to have a regulator, and I would want that regulator to be a private company, mm-hmm, a third-party audit, mm-hmm, that would go in and assure that they were not saving that information for any advertising purposes or anything else, that they really didn't know the content. They were only looking at the ones and zeros for known malware, known attack.
Yeah, it's just so easy to manipulate the bits and change the patterns. I guess, in my view, there is something that Ed and the guys could do, which is watch for big patterns over the network.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like when everybody gets up and flushes the toilet
and
after
they
MASH or whatever.
They do. Question is, what do they do about it?
Right.
And there are some backbones that don't particularly look for these things.
Yeah.
I think AT&T probably does.
Yeah.
But question is, what do they do when they see them? And do they have the legal top cover so that they can step in and do something? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think all of these Tier 1 ISPs are afraid that if they step in and stop a certain packet or a certain trend going on, mm-hmm, that they could be sued because your email didn't get through.
Right.
And I think we need to give them more. I think they have legal top cover now,
uh-huh,
by the way. I think their lawyers are just overly cautious about this. But I'm not a lawyer. So let's, if they think they need more legal top cover, let's give it to them.
Uh-huh. Interesting. I absolutely agree with you that the rush towards a smart grid electrical infrastructure is rife with security risk. And that from a cyber war perspective, attacking the power system makes all kinds of sense. It's like target one. So why is it that the electric grid regulators, including FERC, don't really seem to understand cyber risk at all?
We have been working on FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, for over a decade.
Yeah.
And it's been Chinese water torture. I think slowly we've been dripping and dripping and dripping. Slowly they've gotten the general understanding that they have to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So they issued regulations, finally, that they're not great, but they're a beginning.
They're a start.
Now they have one gaping hole in these regulations. The FERC has no ability to know if anybody's following them or not.
Right, right. Okay?
So they issue the Con Ed, this regulation, and Con Ed says, ah, okay, I'm certified, I'm doing it. FERC wouldn't know whether or not they were doing it if the lights went out. Mm. I mean, FERC has no cyber ability, no audits, and there's no requirement in the regulations that Con Ed gets audited by a third party.
Mm-hmm.
So FERC is not auditing them, and there's no third party audit. So how the hell do we know whether these regulations are being violated?
Exactly. And you know, that's a case where maybe regulation makes sense, because we're always talking about public-private partnership and no regulation. And I know the politics behind all that. But it's there's certain things we've got to protect.
Yeah, you know, I know the regulation, the word regulation, sends most people running out of the room.
It's like liberal.
depends on your hot button. But people don't want regulation until you ask them. You know, the toy that you give your grandson at Christmas, what if it's from China and it's got a lead paint on it and he licks that lead paint off?
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you want the Food and Drug Administration or the Federal Trade Commission issuing regulations about lead paint on toys? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And,
my kid.
You know, and you can go through a whole long list of things where you ask people, do you want this to happen? No. Do you want regulation to stop it? Yes. But somehow, so they like regulation.
Yeah.
But they think they don't like regulation.
That's right.
And somehow when you say, we need new cyber regulations, they all go, oh, no, big government stealing my, you know, emails, like the government wants your emails. What would it do with your email?
Right.
But I think there are some smart regulations that can be done. Now, what do I mean by smart? Where you give me the end state. Don't give me five volumes written by a government lawyer.
Yeah.
Give me an insight. What do you want me to do?
What, not how.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then you don't have a bunch of government inspectors going around checking, like the guys that were supposed to check on the mine in West Virginia,
mm-hmm.
right? And the guys that were supposed to check on the oil well in off Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
and government inspectors. No. You have what we have under some other laws, which is the requirement for third-party audit.
Mm-hmm.
So under the Sarbanes-Oxley financial thing, you have to have, if you're a publicly traded company, you have to have an audit firm come in every year, and it audits you.
Can you imagine telling the CEOs of the power concerns that they could go to jail? I guess they can already under Sarbanes-Oxley, but their books are not a mess.
Yeah, if they're publicly traded now, they have to be inspected by auditors. And by the way, under Sarbanes-Oxley, one of the things that the auditors have to certify of every publicly traded company every year is that their cybersecurity is adequate.
Yep, I've been involved in those battles in New York for sure.
So for some companies, including the banks, by the way, getting audited for cybersecurity is a real phenomenon.
Oh, yeah.
So if the banks have to be audited for cybersecurity, why not the electric power companies?
Mm-hmm. Point taken. Personal freedom and liberty are clearly important to you. How do you balance cybersecurity and individual liberty, avoiding kind of a cyber nanny state or big brother, while also actually addressing cyber risk?
I think it's vitally important that we build up trust between the government and the people. We don't have trust right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have to build up trust. We had warrantless wiretapping by NSA mm-hmm. in the United States.
Yep.
Now, let's just say it. We had warrantless wiretapping in the United States by NSA.
Mm-hmm.
I love the guys at NSA, but
they shouldn't have done that.
They shouldn't have done that.
Right.
And that's a blot on their record. And they lost a lot of trust by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we handle this? I think we need a very robust commission, ongoing commission of trustworthy people.
Mm-hmm.
People, and you see that name, that woman's on that commission, well, I trust her. It's just automatic. People with that kind of reputation.
Mm-hmm.
That is got subpoena power, got a staff of experts, and is independent, and issues public reports, and goes around checking on whether the government is getting into things it shouldn't be getting into in terms of privacy.
Kind of a personal liberty or civil liberties commission.
Right. Now, there is one.
I know. I've met the guys. I did a panel at RSA, and it was a lot of talk.
They're pathetic.
Yeah.
They've never done anything I'm aware of. And nobody even knows they exist, let alone the people who are on it. Mm-hmm. So let's get rid of that one. And let's create one with a lot of power. And let's have a law that creates it, gives it subpoena power, gives it independence. Let's have it issue annual reports and special reports when necessary. And let's have it go around and protect our privacy rights and our civil liberties.
On the NSA front, I worry a lot about putting the NSA or the rest of the intelligence community in charge of cybersecurity.
Oh, I do too.
So my main concern has to do with separation of duties and deconflicting offense and defense. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you imagine spying on your adversaries, spycraft's made way easier if there are problems in software that can be exploited. Mm-hmm. And so if you're in charge of spycraft and in charge of making sure that the advanced systems are secure.
It's a conflict of interest.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it reminds me about the balance we struck during the Cold War when we decided to pull the guys who build weapons and put them into the Department of Energy and the guys who use nuclear weapons and put them into the Department of Defense.
Yep.
And that separation of concerns seemed like a really good idea.
Yeah.
So you're with me on that one?
Yeah. One of the things we say in the book is we'd like to see created a cyber defense administration.
Mm-hmm.
And for lack of a better place, we suggest it be in the Homeland Security Department. Right now, there are a lot of good people in Homeland Security. There are. I mean, the Secret Service does a great job. Coast Guard, I think, does a great job. They're good people. There are 140,000 of them.
It's a very big thing, yeah.
And they're hardworking. They're good people. They just don't have a cyber capability right now.
Right.
Very much. They have a little one. Mm-hmm. And they're aware of that. And they want to build a cyber capability. And they want to consolidate the things they have and get additional powers and additional resources. And calling it a cyber defense administration, I think, would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got all these entities. They've got Secret Service, Coast Guard, and Customs and Border Patrol. You know, so add to one of them at that level, a major agency, a cyber defense administration, so that we don't have to use NSA to do the defense.
That's going to be a heck of a political battle. I mean, even if you think about what the Obama administration, the trouble they had sorting out the National Security Council versus Treasury, you know, that never really got resolved properly.
Right.
And so you end up with somebody with multiple line reports. I was talking to Howard on Thursday.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I'm glad he's doing it, but I still think he's crazy.
Well, it's a tough job.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that, because Howard was not given a clear mandate and clear authority and responsibility.
Right. Yeah, it's more of a cheerleader and consolidator. But, you know, the good thing is that Howard really understands the technical issues behind the thing and has been in the wars, you know, seeing how us geeks try to resolve these things.
Now, Howard's got all the background necessary to do the job, and we'll find out when he tries to propose something serious.
Yeah.
Whether he's got the clout.
Right, yep. So for years you worked on nuclear nonproliferation together with the Russians, back in the SALT and the START days, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all very grateful for that important work, so thanks for that. In nuclear arms control, it seems that verification is at least possible. This may not be the case when it comes to cyber weaponry. So how can you make progress in an arms control sense that so we can control and limit cyber war capabilities?
So arms control verification, whether you're verifying nuclear weapons or the hardest one, biological weapons, or chemical weapons, which turned out to be really hard to do, or even conventional weapons, you know, good counting tanks. And that
sort
of every time we started down one of these roads, and I was present for each of them, I was present for conventional, for nuclear, for bio, and for chemical. Every time we started down one of these roads in arms control, we were told, oh, you can't do it. You can't do it. It's so hard. Verification is going to be so hard.
Yep.
And it was. It absolutely was. And we spent an awful lot of time trying to figure out, and a lot of creativity in trying to figure out how to verify arms control in those areas. And one of the things we discovered is arms control is not a one or a zero function.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a spectrum. You're never going to have 100% verification ability on damn near anything.
Right.
So how much is enough? And that depends on a couple of things. One, what's the risk if you're wrong? You know, if you think that the other guy is playing by the rules, mm-hmm. And he's not.
Then what?
What's the risk to you? That you have to take that into account when figuring out whether this verification system is acceptable or not. So can you verify? It depends on the proposal. There are certainly things about arms control of cyber that you could never verify. Mm-hmm. But there are also probably some things you could. And I think what we're suggesting in the book is let's take some baby steps, just as we did with nuclear and bio and chem. Let's take some baby steps, have some proposals, build up some trust, build up some expertise, begin the international dialogue. You know, in all of these other forms of arms control, it took years
of
talking to each other just so that we understood what we were talking about. You know, we'd be saying the words back and forth to each other, but they'd have different meanings and different understandings.
Yep.
And it took a long time to establish negotiators on both sides of the table, or sometimes multiple sides mm-hmm. to a table, negotiators that were sufficiently expert in the subject matter that we could actually have a negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're saying is let's begin.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some ideas of things that we think are fairly unobjectionable,
mm-hmm.
like having a cyber risk reduction center modeled on the nuclear risk reduction center, which could have an international staff, and you could call it when you were in trouble.
Right.
And you could say, that bad guy is attacking me, and, you know, help me.
Right.
Come verify that it is him that's attacking me. And help me stop the attack and share information. Something like that would be a good first step.
Last question. How does being a guest on Silver Bullet compare to being on the Colbert Report?
You see, with the Colbert Report, you know after one or two serious questions, you're going to get something right off the left field wall.
Right, don't know what it is.
Right off the Green Monster, and you have to, it's live, and you have to respond in an instant because they can't have dead air while you're thinking about
right,
it.
Right, right.
And the rule on the Colbert Report, and for that matter on the Daily Show, is the host is the comedian.
Not you.
Not you.
You're right.
So don't think you have to say something funny.
Yeah.
It's a tough gig to be on.
So a little easier.
It's a little easier.
Glad to hear it. Great, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. S&P's May and June issue examines risk assessment. How can protection poker help secure your software? Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.